We're in Suzdal, a small town that's over 1,000 years old, not too far from the Russian capital. Now, it's managed to pull off a pretty impressive feat. It's become a top tourist destination, but without losing its historic charm. And we're going to find out more about this enchanting place from someone who knows it better than anyone. Alexander, what a picturesque view. How has Suzdal managed to maintain its historic charm and resist the encroachment of the modern world?
I think the explanation dates back to the 1960s, when it was decided to make Suzdal a tourist town. The construction of multi-story apartment buildings was banned. You can't have structures taller than three stories in Suzdal. That's why you can see the whole town from viewpoints like this one. Here, you can get an idea of what a typical Russian town looked like 200 or 300 years ago.
And the river here is the Kamyanka. And the history of this town has to be inextricably linked with this river. What role does it play in the history and the life of the town, and what do people believe when it comes to the river here?
Suzdal lies on an ancient trade route, which historians call from the Varangians to the Persians. It was a part of the Great Silk Road linking the Caspian and the Baltic Seas. If we took this route today, we'd be able to get to present-day Iran.
Really?
Yes.
I don't think the people here will be going to Iran, though.
Not these days, no, because the river is quite shallow. Suzdal was the capital of a principality. Moscow was just a small fortress to the west of the Rostov-Suzdal lands, while this was the capital.
Really? Wow. Okay, shall we go further and explore Suzdal?
Yes, let's go.
Now, when you say the word Kremlin, I guess many people outside of Russia would think of Red Square and the huge wall and buildings next to it. But it is, in fact, a general term for a fortified wall that surrounds a town here in Russia. Now, Suzdal's Kremlin doesn't have that wall. How did it defend itself, and did it ever have to?
It's true that many associate the word Kremlin with what they see in Moscow or other cities like Nizhny Novgorod or Veliky Novgorod. They think of a stone or a brick wall. That's why many of our visitors come looking for a wall like that. In fact, though, all Kremlins were like the one in Suzdal. They were essentially an earth wall with a wooden structure at its core. They filled the wooden framework with rocks, earth, and construction waste, and covered it with clay or earth on the outside, which made the wall taller. There was a moat in this spot filled with water. As a rule, Kremlins would be built on riverbanks, so that the river, as well as the moat, would serve as a protective barrier. A Kremlin was therefore a fortified island. Let's go to the top and take a look from above.
Let's do it.
Let's go.
Alexander, I've heard that the land beneath our feet is so rich with treasures and history and artifacts that archaeologists have to survey it and analyze it before anything can be built or dug up. What sort of things can we find here?
Archaeologists conduct excavations in Suzdal and the Suzdal district every year. They find a lot of silver coins and ornaments dating back to the 9th and 10th centuries. So these artifacts predate the first mention of Suzdal in chronicles. The municipal construction code stipulates that an archaeological survey of the site is required before you're allowed to build a house here. Sometimes they unearth pieces of clay amphoras that were used to ship wine and olive oil. One of the recent finds was a glass ring from the times of the Golden Horde. We literally walk over treasures here.
Amazing. Are there any rules surrounding having to declare these artifacts? Say someone's digging in their garden and they find a coin. Do they have to show it to the scientists and the archaeologists?
There's no simple answer to this question. Imagine you're planting potatoes and you come across a coin. Why would you invite archaeologists? You'd put it in a jar or something. Every gardener in Suzdal has a little jar with old coins. Just think about it. You need to plant potatoes, but instead a team of archaeologists descend on your garden and digs the whole summer. Right, very inconvenient.
So I've also heard that Suzdal's been called an open-air museum because it's just full of history and artifacts. What's the oldest exhibit then in Suzdal?
That would have to be the Cathedral of the Nativity of the Theotokos, the one with blue domes. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site and was built almost 800 years ago. If you go inside, you'll see 13th, 17th and 19th century frescoes.
Well, being in Suzdal, it's almost like travelling back in time to the 19th century. And your outfit certainly fits that, Alexander. What can you tell me about this outfit? I hope you won't be offended if I say, is it a peasant's outfit?
Yes, it's a 19th century peasant's outfit, and as you can see, I'm wearing a festive red shirt today. A typical peasant in the 19th century had three shirts. That was enough. One for special occasions, one for everyday wear, and one for work. Every year, a man would get a new shirt, which would serve predominantly as his festive shirt. Then the festive shirt would be demoted to an everyday shirt. You would tie a kushak, or belt, around your waist, both to look good and for protection, as it was considered a charm against evil spirits.
Oh, okay.
This type of shirt, by the way, is called a kosovarotka, or a skewed collar shirt, because it's buttoned on the side. Why not at the center like yours?
I have no idea.
Let me give you a hint. Why does an Orthodox Christian peasant need a kosovarotka?
To hide the cross? I really don't know. To hide the cross?
Yes.
Okay.
So that when you work bending down, the cross doesn't hang out. Or if your collar is unbuttoned, the cross wouldn't show.
That's logical.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes.
And you're here with the leather boots and the sack and the trousers.
Yes. Let's talk about the leather boots. Many people are skeptical about them. They ask me if peasants were really so rich that they could afford them. There were poor peasants as well as rich or medium income peasants. Many wore leather boots. Sometimes, though, they would walk barefoot around their house or even walk barefoot from village to town, carrying their boots over their shoulders.
To save them.
Right. To save them. To protect them from wear and dirt. Many people know about Puss in Boots. In the cartoon, he walks carrying the boots on a shoulder pole. When you would get to town, you'd rinse your feet in a puddle, put the boots on, and look just dandy. And a hat, of course. It was inappropriate to appear hatless in public.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yes, a hatless man in the streets of Suzdal 100 years ago would look like a guy not wearing pants today.
Wow. Well, I better go and get myself on then.
Yes.
What else can you show me here in Suzdal, Alexander?
As you stroll through the town, you can admire 19th and 20th century houses. Let's go take a look.
Okay, I'd like to see them. Let's go. These wooden houses, Alexander, they're so beautiful, especially the frames around the windows. Are they purely decorative or do they have some sort of meaning as well?
They're both decorative and functional.
Mm.
Window casings cover the gap between the wall logs and the window frame. They have to do with protection as well.
Mm-hmm.
People believed that these solar symbols protected the inhabitants. That's why you can see the sun symbol on windows and gates. This is a very interesting gate. The house itself was built in the early 20th century, but it was decorated by our contemporaries. You can see charms here against evil spirits to prevent them from entering through the windows or gate. Similar symbols would be used to decorate clothes as well.
With the sun symbol, yeah?
Yes, the sun symbol was used by Slavic and other cultures. That's why you can see these charms here.
Well, these homes look so beautiful and cozy. Thanks for telling me all about them, Alexander.
You're welcome.
Now, you can't spend long in Suzdal without hearing the unmistakable sound of church bells ringing out across the town. Let's go and take a closer look. Alexander, we're in Suzdal's main bell tower. What makes it so unique?
The bell tower is, with no exaggeration, twice as unique. Historically, it's the most precious one in our town. Why? For starters, its architecture is not typical for Suzdal. We don't have many gallery-type bell towers. Russians mostly preferred bell towers in the shape of multifaceted pillars. This is one of the only gallery-type bell towers in Suzdal. In addition, we've been able to equip it with bells from before the revolution. These bells aren't modern replicas. They were continuously made between the 16th and 19th centuries. The oldest is from the time of Ivan the Terrible. This set of bells is musically correct, but also consists of historical bells with that unmistakable sound of pre-revolutionary Russia. That's what makes it so valuable.
So the set of bells is different from each bell tower to bell tower.
True, different bell towers have bells with different tones, but it doesn't mean that a bell ringer can't work on a different bell tower. A professional can work any bell tower in our Orthodox world, in Russia or beyond, where the Russian chiming tradition of moving only the clapper is used. When a bell ringer comes to a different town for a festival, he knows what to do. He's going to be in a different key, if you will. But if you play the piano, you can always transpose a melody onto a different key, right? If you play the piano, it's very similar here. A bell ringer is doing the same thing from melodic and rhythmic perspectives, only in a different key. The mechanics will be similar.
Okay, Alexander, you must get asked this question quite a lot, but are you not worried about your hearing, you know, playing such loud bells quite frequently?
Yes, I do get that question a lot. It's true that bell ringers sometimes develop hearing problems, but not always. The Suzdal chime, for example, is known for being delicate. Note how we touch the wall of the bell with the clapper, very delicately. We never plug our ears or wear protective earmuffs, and can retain our musical ears until an advanced age.
Now, Alexander, I've seen it's a very physically demanding task, ringing these bells. You said that one even weighs as much as a car. What sort of connection does this give you to this huge instrument that you're playing here?
The pedalboard here is used to operate the clappers of the big bells. One of them was made in the 16th century in the times of Ivan the Terrible. The left foot operates pedals attached to a weight of 150 kilograms. So it's a physically demanding job as well. The other part of your question was about my connection to them. And here's the important thing. What distinguishes Orthodox Russian chimes is that we can feel all the nuances of how the clapper touches the edge of the bell. A little bit harder, a little bit stronger. We have that at our fingertips. That makes it possible to increase the loudness gradually, a crescendo in musical terminology. It takes a bell ringer decades to master that technique. You can't start doing it straight away. What I felt after decades of work was that a chime can breathe. Another association I have is that it's like braid. The ringer uses their entire body to play. It's like being a spring that compresses and releases, involving every muscle, even the right leg, which you'd think isn't doing very much, is actually part of the action as we bend it slightly. To an outsider, it might seem like we're dancing. But it's the right movement for control. It's all about making the pedal touch softer. We bend on that leg to help.
It really involves your whole body, from your fingertips.
So yes, the whole body is involved, and each ringer has a different connection to the bells. There are waves of sound, flowing waves.
A beautiful way of describing it. Alexander, how did you become a bell ringer, and what does this profession mean to you?
Initially, bell ringing was a hobby for me, but it eventually became a profession. You see, a bell ringer isn't just a musician or someone with a sense of rhythm. Bells are a musical instrument, yes, and with both mathematical and musical patterns. But in our tradition, they're a church instrument.
There are different arrangements for different occasions. Are these arrangements, are they written down on paper? Do you make your own? Do you compose your own music?
Russian bell ringing isn't like playing a piece from a musical score. Imagine trying to set up sheet music here and there. When you start ringing, the wind scatters the pages all over the place and you have to rely on memory. It's not like that. But it's not pure improvisation either. Both assumptions are wrong. Bell ringing in each specific event has a defined beginning, middle, and end, and signals a specific occasion. It's like jazz. You can't play every note the same each time, but you always recognize the theme, like the Pink Panther.
Yeah, of course not.
No matter who plays it, a musician, an orchestra, the theme remains unmistakable. The same goes for bell ringing. You'd never confuse a water blessing peal with a funeral chime, even though each performance might include variations and improvisations.
You add it yourself.
Yes, it's a mix of structure, consistent patterns, and improvisation.
Anton, I was looking around at the audience while you were singing. People seemed to be very touched by your music. One woman was even moved to tears. Why do you think it affects people so much?
I believe people who come to listen to us each have their own story. When their story aligns with the music we're performing, it resonates deeply, touching their heart. If someone unfortunately is going through something sorrowful and we sing a sad and solemn piece, it feels intimate and often moves them to tears. It's impossible to remain indifferent. They can't help it. This happens all the time. Or when someone is happy and we play something joyful and uplifting, you can see the lightness in their expression and feel the joy in their heart.
It seems like many people find your music therapeutic, even cathartic. Is that one of your aims, Anton?
It's not just about performing music. We pour our soul, our energy, into every prayer we sing and secular piece of music we perform in concerts. I think people feel that, and they respond by giving something back to us, a kind of emotional feedback. That connection creates a special atmosphere, especially when there's a large audience. It's a wonderful feeling, and it's so powerful, it gives you chills, a sensation of happiness.
Мой духовный сад, как запущена ты, от негодных трав заросли цветы. Спит душа моя крепким сном давно, не родит она о пути своем. Пробудись от сна, посмотри кругом, что ты спишь, душа, что в саду твоем.
Just like in China and the UK, tea is an important part of many occasions here in Russia as well. And we're lucky enough to have been invited to a traditional tea party here in Suzdal. Maria, hello.
Hello, Peter. Thank you so much. Let's head to the table. We've been waiting for you to join our tea ceremony.
Can you tell me about a traditional Russian tea ceremony? Is it customary for the guests to help set the table?
It's a bit unusual, but I appreciate you offering to help. Normally, when guests arrive, the table is already set, the tea service is arranged, and we sit down to enjoy a beautiful and delicious spread.
My pleasure.
So thank you again for helping out. Now, let's move closer to the table.
I've heard it's a very long process, and sometimes it can even last a full day. What do you do all this time? You can't be drinking tea all day.
We can drink tea practically all day, morning, afternoon, and evening. Whenever guests come over, the hostess always serves tea.
Right.
And when we talk about tea ceremony, it's never just one cup of tea or coffee. It's a continuous process of refilling cups, serving more food. So everything you see here is part of the tea ceremony.
It looks delicious.
Here, on this side, we have plates for food, teacups, and the centerpiece. The teapot with the brew near the samovar, along with cutlery.
So this is the samovar.
The samovar is the king of our table.
And there are a few things more Russian than the samovar. And you use these pine cones and birch bark here to heat it. Does this affect the flavor of the tea?
Yes, really? True. And you can sometimes taste a slight flavor in the water. The best part, though, is when you toss in a pine cone. The aroma from the cones, the smell of the smoke, adds to the overall atmosphere. You should try adding a cone yourself.
Can we do it?
Yes, we'll see now the smoke leaving the chimney.
Amazing.
Yes, go ahead, add some more. And since the tea ceremony can last 2 or 3 hours, we'll need to keep the samovar going to ensure the tea stays hot.
Does the tea from a samovar taste better than from a tea bag and an electric kettle?
Of course. Boiling water in the samovar results in its softening. Carbonates settle on the walls of the samovar and sink to the bottom. The step here is placed slightly above the base, and this is a precise calculation by the craftsman who made it. That way, all the solid particles remain at the bottom, and we drink pure, softened water.
Okay, that's a good reason.
Let's pour hot water into the teapot now, as the tea needs time to brew.
Okay.
A key feature of Russian tea drinking is that the brew and the hot water are kept separate.
Okay.
Now we need to add more fuel to the samovar to keep it hot. And I'll call on my husband to help, as maintaining the samovar is considered a man's job.
Okay.
Ivan.
Help us, please. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Peter.
Ivan.
So this is a traditionally male thing. Yeah.
We'll remove the chimney now, since the fire burns inside the samovar.
And the water is around here.
The water surrounds the heated pipe. So we add the pine cones, and as they catch fire, the water around the pipe heats up. The chimney creates a strong draft, making the flames inside burn even hotter.
It seems like a real art. Get to have a tea ceremony, getting the samovar to work, doing it properly, the fuel that you use, the spread, it's an art.
This is more than just drinking tea. It's a ceremony, a special way of spending time. It's very different from the way we drink tea today. It takes us back to our roots, to childhood. Even the scent of the smoke brings back pleasant memories from the past.
Smells have that effect.
Shall we sit at the table?
Maria, what a wonderful spread you have here on the table. Can you tell me about the different types of food you have?
A proper Russian tea ceremony involves several courses. There should always be something hearty and savory, like pancakes with red caviar or salted redfish, and of course something sweet. We have pancakes with local Vladimir cherries here, homemade merengues, cookies, barankas, Russian bread rings, and even fruit.
All looks absolutely amazing. Thank you, Maria. What do we do now? What's the next step?
Let's pour the tea now. First, we add the brew and then some hot water from the samovar.
Okay.
That way, if we sit here for 2 or 3 hours, we'll always have hot tea, thanks to the samovar.
I've got you. Very clever, very clever. Okay.
Let me help you with that, as the hostess. Let's pour the brew and add some hot water.
And a bit more hot water, yeah. There we are. I'll tell you what. I'll give you that one, Maria. I'll pop that
thank
one.
Thank you very much. And one more cup.
Thank you very much. And what's this tea made of? What are the leaves in the tea?
This is a classic Chinese tea, but we've added Ivan chai or Ivan tea to it.
Okay. And what's Ivan tea?
Ivan tea is made from fireweed, which grows in Suzdal and all over Russia. In the past, it was used to make counterfeit tea. It was mixed with Chinese tea, which was quite expensive, to make it more affordable. But nowadays, there is a renewed interest in history, hence a wave of interest in fireweed. So Ivan tea has become a trend in Russia.
I see it advertised everywhere, Ivan tea, and I've always wondered
what
it was. Cheers, Maria. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's very hot.
Can you taste the distinct flavor of Ivan tea? That's the aroma the fireweed lends to the drink.
Well, what a lovely evening. The weather's beautiful, the company is amazing, and the tea is very
Thank you so much.
Thank you.